delightfully snowy backdrop, Murph, we have today with the flakes coming down outside, the winter trade deadline, NHL trade deadline approaching. Just a lot of good stuff that we're going to be able to talk about today. I'm really starting to feel it. The hockey talk is going to be flowing like wine today.
Well, that's right. I mean, and you're getting football out of the way this weekend. The Super Bowl will be gone, and it's going to be all hockey and basketball in the news media. So, well, I guess this spring training coming too. But, I mean, around Boston, this is that time of year when the Bruins have an opportunity to seize the attention, and you can feel a little buzz around the team, excited to see what they might do down the stretch run.
Don't bother me with spring training, Murph. Let's talk about games that really matter rather than grapefruit league games that don't mean anything at all.
Tell that to mainstream media in Boston.
Yeah, forget about that. We're going mainstream hockey right now. Let's start the show. Welcome to the Great American Hockey Show. I'm your host, Joe Haggerty. My co-host, Bruins Daily writer, James Murphy. Murph, what's going on? It's interesting times. This is when it really starts to heat up and kick up as far as the rumors, the trade scenarios with the deadline only a few weeks away, February 29th. What's your overall sense with the Bruins and sort of what they're thinking and what their approach is as the deadline comes?
Well, I think it's the last time we discussed, Joe, I still think that they're going to be a combination of buyers and sellers. I mean, I still am convinced that Louis Erickson will be shipped out despite some reports recently that maybe they're leaning towards signing him. I don't believe any of it. I can't see it happening. And I think that at the same time, they're going to want to bring back a roster player, whether in that deal or another deal, to help them right now and in the future. So I think it's going to be a combination. And, you know, I think as we speak, Don Sweeney is probably a very busy man.
I think when it comes down to it, Murph, they either pay Louis Erickson on the wing, huge money, big term, or they pay Brad Marchand on the wing, huge money, big term. And I don't even think that's a decision on who you give that kind of money and that kind of term to. If I'm giving a six-year, $6 million-plus deal to anybody, it's the younger guy, the much more physically intense guy, the bigger leader on the team, the guy that shows up in big games. That's absolutely where I'm going. But above and beyond the players that they're selling or potentially selling, like a Louis Erickson situation, let's go with the players that they're buying, and let's throw some names out there of possibilities, and we'll stick to defensemen because I think that's the biggest need and that's the biggest fish that they're after. Let's start with the most obvious one and the one we've talked about the most, Dustin Byfuglien.
You know, Joe, I just, based on recent reports and the way it seems to be going in Winnipeg right now, I'm not sure he's going to be there on the market. I get a feeling right now that they're starting to lean, if you know, they're going to have to make a choice between Andrew Ladd, their forward and captain there, or Dustin Byfuglien. It seems to me that they're leaning towards Byfuglien. And if you read between the lines on some of the things that Byfuglien said at the All-Star break and the days after it, he's hinting that he'd really like to stay there. He loves the atmosphere there. He loves that he can take a short ride and be ice fishing and exploring the Great White North. And he likes that. And I think he's going to lean towards staying there. And if not, this is a guy that, you know, is going to be an impending UFA. He's going to be a UFA July 1st, which tends, you know, with all these things he's saying about the setting that he likes, it makes me believe that he's not going to be a guy that the Bruins would be able to sign if they were to acquire him. So for that reason, I think the Bruins back off there.
There's some places to fish in New England. Come on, Murph. I agree with you. I also think the price would be too high, as you're saying, is they wouldn't be able to re-sign him just to bring him in for a little bit. That kind of huge, big fish rental I don't think makes sense for this Bruins team. Yeah, absolutely. And the one interesting thing, though, is if Dustin Byfuglien stays and they sign him, as I'm hearing the same thing you are, then that might all of a sudden make Tyler Myers, Jacob Trouba available because they need to trade somebody away. So I think that's a situation in Winnipeg to watch very closely, but maybe Dustin Byfuglien isn't that guy, even though he's got the size, the power play ability, the surliness, all that stuff.
I just think, too, that a guy like I'm not really sold on Myers. He's kind of
– No, Trouba's the guy you would want.
Right, he's underachieving. But I think Trouba is the guy you should be targeting from the get-go because
– Well, I think they have, but I think
he's younger, he's got term, and he fits in. But he's going to cost a boatload.
Yeah, and you're not going to get him, I think, until the summertime anyway.
Exactly. It's a draft day deal.
Yeah. Next up, and this is an interesting one because he's currently serving a suspension, Dennis Wiedemann, who from everybody you talk to, the Bruins were interested up until the suspension. It would have been interesting to have him back here. I mean, I think he would have been a fine short-term stopgap thing, and he certainly wouldn't have been cost a lot as far as what to trade in return. What do you think of Wiedemann?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing for sure that they're looking at him again and they want to maybe go back to something they already know and they've had and they deemed wasn't successful here. And there's still plenty of management folks in Boston that were there when they traded Wyman away. So I don't see much that's changed in his game. I think he's still pretty much what he always has been. He's gonna provide offense. He can be a good puck mover, but he can drive you nuts too. And I think he's the type of guy, too, that's going to give Claude Julien fits on the bench.
As he did last time.
And
I mean, Murph, I remember when he was here originally, he told all of us when he was going through a low period that he just couldn't find, like, the emotion and the energy, and he couldn't find the inspiration. He just wasn't into it. And then the next day when Claude Julien saw the quotes, he stuck them right in front of the net at practice and had Zdeno Chara firing slap shots at him in a tip drill as a means of saying, oh, you're not into it? You're going to find a way to get into it.
Great minds think alike, Joe. I was just going to say the one thing I'd be careful of, too, with him now is his mental stability.
Yeah.
Because this is a guy now that's coming back from a pretty – I don't think traumatic is the word. It's a little, you know, exaggerating here, but a pretty unpleasant experience. Experience there with the suspension and people kind of labeling him as a dirty guy and a jerk for what he did. And he definitely just snapped in my eyes. I mean, I think he knew what he was doing, but he was also not there mentally. And as you said, that's always been the case with him. Yeah, he's fragile. So,
and he's always had brain farts on the ice.
Do the Bruins need – is that the type of guy they need and they're going to be tied into him for $5.2 million again next year? I don't think that's what they need.
Yeah, I think where they're coming from is obviously that Chara has a comfort level with him, having played with him before in a partnership, and he's certainly better than what they have now
we'll get a top pairing guy.
But
Chara there.
I think this would be one of the solutions that wouldn't cost a lot and maybe a little lower on the rung if they can't go for the pie in the sky. Keith Yandle, I've had sources tell me he's not going to move this year unless the bottom completely drops out for the Rangers, which I don't think is going to happen. I think this is a much better chance of maybe him signing with the Bruins in the summertime as a free agent rather than them giving up assets.
So we're not
going to
have
right
the
now.
Hundreds and hundreds of Yandle to Boston rumors
well,
in the next month?
It would end all that. But the bottom line is I don't see Yandle going anywhere unless the Rangers completely bottom out.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the Rangers are kind of seeing their window closing as far as going for it is. And I think that they went through some tough times and they've somehow still stayed afloat. And I think they're going to go for it one more time. So they'd probably be content. Hey, if he walks, he walks. But at least we give it a whirl to go and make a run in the playoffs.
Like Kevin Shattenkirk, he would fit all the Bruins' needs.
I think
he's a phenomenal
the dream
solution.
Guy right there.
Yeah, that's the one that they want. The question
29
is,
other clubs.
Right. The question is, what is it going to cost and how much would the Bruins have to give up? And are the Blues going to trade him given some of the injury situations that they've had with their defensemen? Is he still in a position where they would trade him, or is this something that the Bruins, like some of the other deals, would have to pursue in the summertime?
Yeah, it might be one of those, but the one thing that could help them in that pursuit of Shattenkirk or maybe somebody else on the St. Louis Blue line is that the St. Louis Blues are starved for offense.
Yeah, they need forwards.
They really need forwards, and Erickson would solidify that, at least for the stretch run this season and in the playoffs. And they can figure it out later when he's a UFA. But they're definitely one of those teams that maybe has defensemen and needs offense. So there is a match there, just like there is in Winnipeg. There's a fit there, and that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and there was some discussion with Louis and TJ Oshie when he was there last year, a potential trade there. So they like Louis Erickson. Justin Schultz from Edmonton, who obviously hasn't had the greatest numbers with the Oilers, but I think that's a tough situation there. I think he still has some skills, and he's still, really young, 25 years old. I think that's an interesting one if somehow Don Sweeney and Cam Neely can decide they want to start talking trade with Peter Chiarelli and get over, their breakup and make something work.
Yeah, that is a real interesting one. And of course, we've heard tons of Oilers names since Chiarelli went there, and even before then, linked to the Bruins in terms of trades. We always hear Jordan Eberle or Taylor Hall. I don't think any of those guys are moving now that they've got McDavid back and they all seem to be blending in.
They might even make a playoff run.
They might even make it. So I don't see any of that happening right now.
Yep.
I think definitely it could be a guy like Schultz that you could get on the blue line there. But, it's interesting. I don't know. I haven't watched him carefully enough, Joe, to see why he didn't work in Edmonton. Obviously, the system is not built towards defense there. I get that. But at the same time, there's just been something missing. Maybe he was just too overhyped. I don't know, but that's he's a question mark as far as I'm concerned.
And the last ones here, Cam Fowler, Sammy Vatanen, Hampus Lindholm, trio of young D-men for the Anaheim Ducks. I think this is another one.
Another good fit?
Yeah, especially Vatanen. I love his game, even though he's not the biggest guy. And Lindholm is a physical guy and a skilled
guy.
He's
not going anywhere from what I'm told. Yeah. That is the guy that I think Anaheim is honed in on that they want to lock up long term. So it's either between Vatanen or Fowler. And I keep hearing from everyone I talk to in Anaheim that they love Fowler and they don't understand why his name's always out there. They're really high on him. So that leaves Vatanen. I'm with you. I think he could be the guy that the Bruins go after. And again, that's another fit, like
that
we said.
That needs forwards. Scoring, that Louis Erickson would be a nice fit with a package of players going back there. And a couple of safety school type choices here. John Michael Lyles and Dan Hamhuis. Maybe if everything else follows through, those might be options there as well. But, you know, those are the names that are out there. Those are the names the Bruins are going to be choosing from. And now Don Sweeney has a few weeks to get it done. Well, we have here a great guest, a former Boston Bruins forward, played for a number of teams in the NHL, played over 1,000 games, is now the assistant GM of the New Jersey Devils. He's also a Massachusetts native, a local guy that did everybody proud with his long stint in the NHL. Tom Fitzgerald. Tommy Fitz, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Also, you forgot, I'm also the father of an NHL drafted Bruin.
That's you go.
Correct.
That's right.
Keeping in the family.
I'm doing well, guys.
The proud father, Tommy.
Very proud.
We start every interview off just by talking to you a little bit in each guest about their hockey origins, where they got to love the game, who instilled the love of hockey from them, where they grew up. So where did you grow up, and where did you first get the love for hockey that you've obviously had your entire life?
Well, my parents are all originally from Charlestown, grew up there. That's where I started my youth hockey, you know, and then they moved my brother and I up to Billerica. But I continued to play youth hockey in Charlestown right up until about eight or nine, and then they just hockey. I would say, you know, obviously the Bobby Orr era, you know, back then in the early 70s, the mid-70s, very impactful. The Bruins, you know, back then you ask a kid now if you name every player, every trainer, every coach. I'm not sure they can name every person. But back then it was it really was an important part of this area. And I was a huge sports fan, you know, Red Sox fan, Celtics, Patriots. But hockey seemed to be my love. My dad, who played a little bit, is probably the inspiration behind me playing, my brother and I. And, you know, he tells stories of us, you know, him paying $1 for us to public skate or learn to skate. And we wanted to come home because our feet were cold. And he pushes back out there because he paid $1 and he didn't want to lose his dollar. And he takes the claim that if he let me off, maybe I wouldn't have played hockey. But no, my dad was very, very inspirational in both my brothers and I and myself's career, and even his grandkids, my sons, and all his grandkids. He was a big part of it. We lost him before Christmas, and you know, he's sorely missed. But he is probably the biggest influence I had in my career.
Sounds like that's where the Fitzgerald work ethic came from.
Yeah, you know, he'd always say to me and my brothers, it's not hard to work hard. It's hard to score goals. It's hard to get points, you know, because things have to, you know, you got to battle an opponent who doesn't want you to score. And, you know, in my pro career, I would have, you know, that's when I played for the Bruins, I went 51 games without a goal. You know what that was like? That's awful. But he'd always say, even up to my last year of playing, I was 37 years old, and he just said, you know what, again, good things happen to people who work hard. And you know what? Something will go off your head, your chest. And I remember the goal that I scored, it was against Tampa Bay. I just was dumping it on net, and it found its way behind the goal line. And, you know, I've always taken those words and really have stood by them. And you know what? Those are the same simple words that I give my own boys in sports in general and life in general. Working hard, it's like breathing. If you don't breathe, you can't live. It has to be automatic. So, you know, those are just you know, the simple words of encouragement that I had to my dad.
What What was it like growing up in that era in Boston, especially your formative years when you were a little older before you got to the pros? There was so much talent, local talent, Massachusetts kids around your age that were in the league. Yeah. And, you know, it must have been pretty special to, you know, have all those peers around that were all from the same area going up through all the ranks.
No, you're right. It was a different era. It's completely different than what it is now. You know, we didn't have, if there was select hockey, there was maybe five or six teams throughout this state. I played for my town. I played for Billerica Youth Hockey growing up. I played with the same kids from like I told you, when I moved to Billerica and played second year mites right up until midgets. And 10 of the kids, we went to Austin Prep together. So I went through high school with them as well. It's different. We practiced once a week and we played one game a week. You might have had two games on a weekend. We all played around this area. It was called the Wilmington League. And you didn't have home games. You went to Wilmington on the weekends and you played Medford or you played, you know, Manchester, New Hampshire, or you played Woburn or Burlington or Stone. It didn't matter. Like that was hockey back then. And then you went away on some tournaments. But I think the most important thing growing up, and I tell this to my kids, and it's important as well watching my own kids grow up. And I have a, you know, Ryan Casey and my son Jack, they have a little brother. He's 12 years old and he's a peewee. I think it's important to play youth hockey with one team and try to stay on that team because you need friends forever. And that's my best friends are my friends growing up, my friends in high school, and really the majority of them are from Billerica because of the bond we had. But you know what? I was also very lucky because that was the 1980 gold medal, you know, era. 1980, I was 11 years old. I was a peewee. And you know what? That was very impressionable to me as a hockey player. And then you really look forward to once you get into high school, you know, what high school you're going to go to. And I tell people, I when I played for the Bruins, my goal wasn't to play for the Boston Bruins. That was pro hockey. I never thought that was real. I wanted to play at Billerica High School because that's who I went and watched every Friday night as a kid growing up. And I idolized those guys. And that's where I wanted to go. But my parents had different plans for me, and they sent me to the all-boys school in Reading, Austin Prep, which also obviously worked out myself. But, no, this area, I think hockey in this area back in my generation was as big as it was because everybody played in the same fishbowl. Everybody played high school hockey. Everybody played hockey night in Boston. So you always played against the best, and you can line yourself up against, you know, I tell people all along, like, Scott Young was my guy that I wanted. He set the bar, and I wanted to be better than Scott Young. So he kept me on my toes when we played against each other. And I tell my kids the same thing. Who's the bar for you? Who can you, you know, raise your game to compete with? And I think that's helped me a lot, even when I turned pro. You know, not to be long-winded here, but you guys saw him here in Boston, Rob DeMaio. And Robbie and I came into the Islanders together back in 1988, 5 years, 4 years in the organization because he went off to Tampa Bay in the expansion draft. But in those first 4 years, and we were best friends, but he was the guy who pushed me to be the best player I could be because it was either him getting called up or it was going to be me getting called up. And in the meantime, we just had so much respect for each other. We became really close even to this day. And I really believe if it wasn't for these guys, I don't know what kind of hockey player I would have turned out to be.
Fitz, if you could take us back to when you were drafted back in 1986, you went in the first round, 17th overall to the Islanders. Just that feeling that you had made it and that your name was being called by a pro hockey team. And I guess follow that up with what it was like to see your son go through that as well afterwards.
Well, you know, it was an unbelievable experience in my own draft year. I would say the dream started after my freshman year in high school when, you know, the likes of Tom Barrasso and Kevin Stevens, all these local kids, Alan Bourbeau, were all getting drafted from this area. Then the next year after my sophomore year, now I'm playing against the Matinons and I'm playing against Tom Glavin and Phil Ricca. And you see the Stephen Leeches and the John Morrises and Chelmsford and the Tommy Glavins. And the list goes on and on. You see all these kids get drafted. And that's when it finally hit me like, wow, in 2 years is I'm draft eligible. And maybe there's a chance I can get drafted. I think hockey night in Boston had a huge impact too on all of us around here because of that. I talk about that fishbowl mentality. You know, Lance and Darby, who owned Hockey Night in Boston, they got the best from all of New England to play against each other. And you had general managers coming into Sona Marina. You had all these scouts. And then they created this super series, Team Massachusetts versus Team Minnesota. So I got a chance to play on that. And then they made it bigger with Team New England, Team Mass, Team Minnesota, Team Michigan. It was just an incredible summer. I mean, that's what you look forward to, and that's what you got in shape for. And that was your time to showcase your talent. You know, my son obviously went through it. It was hard. It was a hard year, not going to lie, for me being on the management side. And, you know, you see the ups and downs. But at the end of the day, you know what, Ryan had a lot of pressure on him, just like any other kid. I thought he handled it great. He got taken where he got taken by his hometown team that, you know, just made it that much more special. You know, it was just a great day for our family. You know, a great day for our family. And, you know, on the flip side of that, you know, my son Casey, who's having a really strong year of Boston College, you know what? It was a hard day for him. He did not get drafted his draft year. But you know what? It made him, I don't want to say work harder, it just made him relax and just go play and, you know, be able to play with his brother at Boston College. And, you know, there's a chance he gets drafted this year. But you know what? It's the emotional roller coaster as a dad. I'm no different than any parent. I just happen to work in the industry, and that might be a little bit harder.
Do you lament just that nowadays it's way different as far as, you know, the experience for a kid around here and sort of the pathway to get to where you did, to get drafted and to get to the NHL? I mean, you almost never see those kids play with their high school buddies or even, you know, play at an Austin Prep. That's become, you know, the rarity rather than the regular situation. And Hockey Night in Boston, a lot of those kids don't play there anymore and stuff like that. I mean, has it just the world just fundamentally changed, especially New England, as far as, you know, path?
Yeah, for good, you know, whether it's good or bad, you know, junior hockey has become a big thing here in New England. And, you know, maybe the public school kid doesn't get – no, he definitely doesn't get the recognition that a public school kid got, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Never mind close to 30 years ago in my era. But so there are now options for these kids. Well, that option became an option for everybody. But I'll tell you this. You know what? My boys, I would never change their path. I thought Malden Catholic was great for them. They got to experience high school hockey. They got to experience, you know, the student body coming out and cheering them on. They got to experience the Boston Garden. You know, Ryan, 3 out of 4 years. Casey was only there for the 2 years before he moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan at the National Development Program, but he was 2 for 2. And, you know, it was culture. It was every spring, every March 18th night, whatever that Sunday was, my family, we were going to the Garden to watch our boys play. And that to me is something that no one can ever take away from them. Even though someone might say, well, you should play junior hockey, you should move out to the USHL, you should go to Ann Arbor. Like, you know what? They experienced the pinnacle here in Massachusetts, and I would never change that. And with that being said, you know, the amount of kids that, whether they were at St. John's Prep or Malden Catholic, even Austin Prep, kids are getting scholarships from high school hockey. Now, the colleges might say, hey, to prepare for your freshman year, we might want you to go play junior. Hey, that's different. You know, to me, that's different. But they got recognized from high school hockey, their experience here. And hockey's not a big – it is a big game around the world now, but there really isn't a player that falls through the cracks anymore. There's so many – every organization has, between 15 and 20 scouts. I mean, it's hard to fall within the cracks. So if you're a player, whether you're playing at – you work at high school, North Reading High School, and try and move on, somebody will find you. Somebody will give you an opportunity. I just think believing in yourself and believing in what you do, and most importantly, enjoying where you're at, not go somewhere because this is where they told me to go. I don't think that works.
You played, Fitz, for a lot of different teams, had a lot of different teammates during your NHL career. Who was your favorite sort of like personality or you know, the person you tell the most stories about now after the fact when you're sort of trading hockey stories with people?
Well, yeah, you're right. I played on seven teams. You know, two of them were trade deadline teams and great experience because you're in the playoffs and you're just a piece. And, you know, then you moved on. And, you know, my 5 years in New York, you know, guys like Pat Flatley and Glenn Healy, you know, come to mind. An older guy like Gary Nyland, just great personalities, funny, kept the room loose. You know, they just made you laugh. Then I went to, you know, the Brian Scrudlins and the Mike Huffs and the Dave Lowry's and stuff. Like, these guys all had personalities. These are the guys that I looked up to when I went my 5 years there. You know, in Nashville, I was there for 4 years and led that young team as captain. You know, Bill Holder was a guy that just made me laugh. He was a character, you know. And then obviously Toronto, and I got a chance to play with Ty Domi, and he is a character. I'll just leave it at that. He is, and he's a good friend. But you know what? He was a character. So, you know, each stop I had, there was always somebody. Brian Marchman, you know, just good. Joe Neuwendijk, good people that you see nowadays because a lot of us are still in the game. And it was like we played 10 years together rather than just 1 year in Toronto. You know, and here in Boston, you know, Hal Gill was a special player. He was funny. He was, you know, he was from here. He had a lot of pressure on him playing here as a big man. But, you know, Hal, I consider a friend still. And, you know, he obviously made a big impact in the room because he kept things loose. So, you know, just off the top of my brain, those are a few of the guys that really, you know, I look back and think, wow, they took hockey in stride. It was fun. It was a game. It wasn't life. And they enjoyed their life.
I still remember sometimes Hal Gill's iPod would get put on the room on the speakers, and all of a sudden you'd start hearing Celine Dion blaring through the Bruins dressing room, which is a pretty odd thing. But if you can go back to Toronto for a second, Fitz, is there one like Ty Domi story that you can tell everybody that's you know, suitable for everybody's listening?
Oh yeah, sure. This guy was, like I said, he's a good friend. Talk as intense as he was on the ice, there were times he was as intense off. And we had a trip to Tampa Bay, and we were pulling into that Marriott right by the rink there. Beautiful area, waterfront area. And I think we played the night before. We played that night in Florida, so we get in late. And every single time, and I didn't really realize this, but every time we were checking into a hotel, Ty's key was missing. Someone took his key. Finally, he got fed up. And because it was late, you know, we had a game that next day. And he gets in, and he thinks it's Thomas Caberle who's stealing his key, but he has no idea. He just thinks it's him. So we're in the elevator, a bunch of us, Thomas included, in our elevator. And we all hear, "Where's my key?" And he just didn't say key. He used adjectives. He was screaming at the top of his lungs. And his voice kept getting louder. And he's walking. Now the voice is getting louder because you know he's getting in the elevator doors are just about to close. And he throws his fist in between the doors before it shut. And he cries the thing open. And he grabs Thomas Caberle, literally picks him up by the collar of his shirt. And Caberle. Caberle's yelling, "Ty, it wasn't me. So he puts him down. Ty goes up with us in the elevator. "I'm sick of this. I'm so fed up with this. I can't believe it." So we're up on the 19th floor. So now he doesn't have his bag, right? He gets back down. He has to go all the way back down. His key is there. He now comes back upstairs, and he's screaming at the top of his lungs because someone now took his bag and hit his bag because he left his bag to go to the elevator to beat up.
Why would
Thomas
you want
to
tick off Ty Domi? I don't get this.
And he banged on every door. Who's got my bag? And finally, I'm thinking to myself, he's banging on my door. He comes in. "You have my bag. You have my," screaming. Poor Rick Jackman was my roommate. He's like, and he goes to the next room. And finally, I'm thinking, my God, whoever took his bag, got to throw it out the window and have the front desk go get it off the sidewalk. Turns out it was Michael Renberg. Michael Renberg came out and just admitted it, and Ty was crushed. He was crushed that his good buddy Michael Renberg was the one always taking his tea. But I thought, whoa, this guy is certified. Oh, man.
Aye, aye, aye.
But, yeah, so that's one of the good stories.
Oh, yeah.
I want to ask you, Fitzy, about another story. You know, and they're a great team this year, surprising a lot of people, as the Florida Panthers. And obviously you were on that team that went to the Stanley Cup Finals with them in 1996. It lost to the Avalanche there. But that was the year of the Rat. And, you know, for some of our younger listeners, they might not be familiar with that. Why don't you tell our listeners about why that played a significant role in that playoff run?
Yeah, that was the year Doug McClain became our coach. Brian Murray was the second year as our general manager. As you probably remember, Bobby Clark was the original general manager of that Panther team. The year started off. We got our first home game, and you know, we played out of the old Miami Arena. I mean, I think it held like 14-7. It was a great barn, you know, because if we had 90% capacity, it still looked, you know, crowd. It was a great atmosphere. But we all lived up in the Boca area, so we had we had day rooms and stuff down there, like the Rangers used to do. Like, they'd drive into the city, have day rooms and play, and we did the same thing. Mm-hmm. So opening night, we're playing the Calgary Flames, and when I say a makeshift locker room, like, it was all wood. You know, there was no paint, there was no bricks, there was nothing. It was just they made it right in the middle of by the Zamboni. Like, picture a locker room where the elevator is at the Garden, right?
Yeah.
You know, training rooms where, because they transfer, all it was just for the games.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't keeping anything there. We never practiced there. And anyways, you know, if you could imagine, it was rat infested, like the old Garden. And Scott Mellenby, you know, was taping his stick. He was standing in the middle of the locker room, and out of nowhere, this big rat just ran down the hall and came into the room, and he reacted and took a slap shot and just whacked the thing into just put a dent into the wall, and the thing died right there. So they clean it up, and they, you know, eventually, so long and short of the story, Scott goes out and scores 2 goals, and after the game, again, the reporters in a small room, we're still getting undressed, and tell us about your game, Scott. And, you know, John Van Biesbrook throws out, he got the rat trick. So that's how it all started. And ironically, Chinese New Year was the year of the rat.
Oh, my God.
So it was funny. It was like, wow, these are just falling in place for this team. You know, so, yeah, that's how it started. And then all the rubber rats and, you know, right through the playoffs, if you can remember, Barrasso being, you know, barraged by all these things, got to hide in his net. But it was a great experience. You know, it actually became a nuisance in a way that, you know, if we scored and we were up by a couple goals, here come the rats. It was like a timeout for the opposing team. all in fun, all in good fun.
Nice.
It's always good to see the Florida crowd, though, which can, you know, sometimes be touch or go, get into it like that and actually, you know, have some kind of, you know, activity that they're involved in. I mean, Florida obviously has a really good team right now, but I remember when I first started traveling, covering the games on the road, they would actually have to announce on the PA when it was offside and when it was icing, like to let the crowd know what was going on.
Yeah. And that was all part of, you know, growing a non-traditional hockey market like South Florida. And we were lucky because there were a lot of transplants there. You know, there were a lot of New Englanders down there, a lot of Canadians, a lot of, you know, Quebec people down there. So you had a market within the market, kind of. You just had to pull them out. And there was a lot of people understood the game, but there were a lot of Floridians who didn't. And that was part of the responsibility of being a Panther, especially as a, you know, an inaugural Panther. You know, we were in the band, and we were going out touring, and we were caravanning around South Florida, across Alligator Alley, over Naples, putting on clinics. You know, that was our responsibility, sell hockey in South Florida. So when you you see the team do well or not do well, you take it, you know, it hits you because you're part of that upbringing, I guess, down there. And I'm glad to see them doing well. They drafted well. They've got a lot of good young talent sprinkled with some good veterans. You know, Gerard Gallant is a really good person. He is showing the world that he's a really good coach. So, you know, I'm happy for them. And as an ex Panther, it's nice to see. We're actually, it's 20 years this year for that 96 team.
That's
and we're
right.
all getting together in March. They're bringing us all down there to rekindle the old times. Imagine that. We didn't even win the cup, and they're bringing us down. But and you know what? And just moving forward, that's a big reason why I chose to go to Nashville, a non-traditional market, you know, yeah. a chance to do what we did in Florida and be the leader of it, and, you know, try to grow the game and get out there and teach people, you know, what the game of hockey is, offside. Hockey 101, they called it. You know, I was trying to educate them. That's 9 years of my career out of 17, 18 years. I was in non-traditional markets, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
You know, I want to segue that kind of, Fitzy, because we're running low on time here now, and I just want to get to your present job. And, you know, you had the experience there in Florida, in Nashville, kind of building a culture, obviously within the community, but also with a team too. I'm imagining with younger players when you were in Nashville there, you know, being a captain there. And we were speaking recently before a Bruins game, you and I, and you were just talking about, you know, why New Jersey has been so successful so quickly here under Ray Sherrow and you and the new regime there and John Hines. And the first thing you said was culture. And I'm wondering, was that one of the main attractions to taking the job, to leaving the Penguins organization, to go to the Devils? You knew Ray Sherrow very well. To go there and help reform a winning culture in New Jersey.
Well, you know, that true, but, you know, we're talking about the New Jersey Devils, and really, let's think about it, over the last two decades, they probably have been the model organization run by Lou Lamoriello, mm-hmm. who, you know, in the players, and the Marty Brodeurs, who's getting his jersey retired on Tuesday night, the Scott Stevenses, the pillars that Lou brought there to build and continue to build around those guys. I'll tell you, from an outsider, you always looked in and wondered, geez, I always wanted to play for the Devils because of the culture they had. I don't know where it slipped. I don't know where it went, nor do we concern ourselves with it. We know how we want to play. We know that we want to be a fast, attacking, aggressive team, and we need guys who want to skate, and we need guys who want to attack. We need guys who want to check, and that's the reason why, you know, Ray went out and found John Hines as his coach. Now, I came in after this, you know, so, but it's no surprise how Ray wanted the culture to be. You know, things are open. We're very open, Ray and myself. You know, we ask for information. We talk to people. We want to feel that people are empowered to do certain jobs. What would you do here if you're talking to a trainer? How many track suits do you think I should have? Well, you know, allowing them to do their job. And I think that empowerment has really helped us. I think New Jersey, the one thing I didn't know about New Jersey was I didn't realize how good Corey Schneider was. So we have that goal. You have that pillar that you can build upon. And I think most importantly, the way Ray sold it to me was exactly what you've been just talking about with my career. We have to look at rebuilding New Jersey. We've got to build a culture. We've got to build a new audience. You know, we have to show our fans that we're a team that they're proud of, that we're going to work and we're going to compete. That to me, you know, Ray obviously looked at it like an Ottawa or Nashville in his managerial career, mm-hmm. And that was attractive to me. You know, we've got cap space. You know what? We've got opportunity. You know, so. That's the part that's fun. That's the part that's exciting. We do have a few really good prospects that we're really excited about. There's a lot of things that excite you as a manager. But at the end of the day, you have to win. You have to show the fans that you're going to continue to work hard and they can be proud of the product on the ice. And that's what we're trying to do.
What's the approach, Fitzy, this month, with the Devils, as far as the trade deadline goes, knowing that you're developing something and you're building something here, but also, you know, you're in the playoff picture right now and you have the cap space, like you talked about, you've got some assets. Like, how much of it is sort of watching what you've built sort of continue to develop and also, you know, going out and potentially giving up assets to add to that team, to give them that little nudge over the edge there coming up to the deadline?
That's the unknown, right? Because we still have, you know, 3 weeks left. you know, till that day or just over 3 weeks. That's the unknown. Where are we going to be in 3 weeks? Are we still going to be there? You know, do we go out and tinker with our roster? Do we, I can tell you what we won't be doing. We won't be selling the farm. We won't be selling off assets to get rentals for sure. That's not going to be us. We are in no situation there that we can afford to do that. No, Ray has a goal. It's long term. You know, it's continue to grow within the organization. And quite honestly, that's what the Devils were in the 1990s, in the 2000s. They drafted so well.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure there'll ever be a Stanley Cup and Calder Cup winning organization in the same year.
They were the Patriots in 1995. In my eyes, they really were.
Yeah, you know what? They really were. And you know, that's something that it's obviously going to be a little harder. But we feel that we have some pieces that we can build around. And we've got some draft picks this year. We've got some excitement with our group about the draft. Whether we draft 16th because we made the playoff, or 14th because we made the playoffs, or not made the playoffs, or we fall out of it, it doesn't change the long term plan. It really doesn't. We're building long term here. We're building long term success, and there's no way we'd sell the farm just for short term gain.
Last question, Fitzy. You touched on this a little bit, Casey and Ryan at Boston College, and you know, what's that been like for you to just be able to, you know, watch them at home when you're here play, whether it's the Beanpot or you know, over at the Heights, and just the approach as the dad that played, like, you know, giving advice or, you know, sort of having notes for them after the game is over, and also, you know, wanting to sort of back off and let them do their own thing.
Well, it's a tightrope for sure. You know, you walk, and you know, first off, it's with my wife and I, and Ryan and Casey's two brothers, Brendan and Jack, we're very fortunate that we get a chance to watch our boys play college hockey at a great college like Boston College, but do it together and be able to kill two birds with one stone instead of pulling out the iPad like we used to do and watch Casey out in the development program. And we're very fortunate, you know, to be part of a school like Boston College. They know that, you know, education is first and foremost important to them. And being able to watch them play, I'm way more relaxed now because they are what they're going to be, you know, and I can give them little tidbits. I can tell you they're different. You know, one's a defenseman, one's a forward. You know, Ryan plays all three forward positions. Casey can play left or right D. They're both undersized for their position, but they're extremely smart. They're extremely competitive. They're extremely skilled, and there's a care factor, and I believe they're gamers. So when the game's on the line, it just seems like they rise. And, you know, getting down, just words of encouragement, Hank, just, you know, telling them things, maybe Casey's stuff on his retrievals, you know, this or that, or Ryan, you know, just, hey, remember, hold on to that puck. You're strong in your skates. You make people take it from you. Because when you get time and space, the game's real easy for you. You know, you can see those little steam passes. And, you know, I'm just extremely proud of both of them. All my boys, you know, Hags, I follow you on Twitter. I know how proud you are of your family. And
absolutely.
That's the way I am. I'm just a dad. That's all I am. I'm a dad that has a pretty long hockey background. I wish the best for my kids. Do they have a chance? Absolutely they have a chance. Why can't they have a chance like anybody else? You know, so, but things have to align for every single player out there. You know, first you need an opportunity. Second, you have to take advantage of that opportunity. Third, you need to be consistent with your opportunity and stay in the lineup. And that to me is hard, but it can be done. So, no, I'm very proud of them, very lucky. And, you know, for me personally, being in New Jersey, being able to watch them, I can go and watch them, and I can watch three prospects too, because we've got Santini, Miles Wood, and J.D. Dudek play at Boston College.
So you're on the clock.
But I never take pretty in.
There you go. Nothing better than hearing a proud papa talk about his boys playing hockey. Fitz, thank you very much for the time, and thanks for that story of Ty Domi rampaging through the Waterside Marriott Hotel in Tampa. We appreciate that.
And the rat.
And the rat.
Take it easy, Fitz.
All right, guys.
Have a good one, Fitzy.
All right, anytime. See you around.
All right, Murph. One interesting thing to look at here is the Eastern Conference, the Atlantic Division, and you know, we could talk about how teams are all bunched up. Florida's starting to separate a little bit. Are they real? Are they fraudulent? There's been a lot of argument back and forth. But I think what people are fascinated most by is the absolute dumpster fire that is the Montreal Canadiens and what's going on there. I mean, you obviously are around that team quite a bit, yeah, and have been in the past. Like, what's your take of that entire situation and what's going on there? What's at the heart of this?
Well, in the famous words of a coach that I believe will be fired by Monday, Michel Therrien,
yes,
they're soft. They're soft. And I think he's gone soft, too.
So this isn't just Carey Price hurt.
No.
He was hiding a lot of imperfections in a substandard roster and saving them on a regular basis. Like, I'm sure that's part of it, but that's not the main thrust of this.
And I think the players believe they were better than they were. And I think having Price out has kind of woken them up to reality, and they haven't been able to handle it.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously they've got some flaws on that team. Maybe the dressing room is
maybe get a number one center someday.
Well,
you know?
that's been an imperfection on that roster throughout, you know. And
The leadership.
Galchenyuk's a good player.
Right. But he's not there yet.
No, and he's not a top-line center. You could see when they're playing the Bruins and he tries to go up against a Bergeron or a Krejci, how much trouble he has as a young guy. They are building, right? But are they at a point where they're bottoming out so fast? And Francois Gagnon, I think, talked on the radio about this, selling off their core group, like getting rid of some of the veteran players. He even mentioned P.K. Subban as a potential guy that they would move on from, which I think is never going to happen in a million years. He's the face of that franchise. But it's interesting that some of the Montreal writers would go there.
Well, I think he's going there. You know, Francois is a very connected guy up there, and I think he's going there because he's got fed some info from there. I think they very well might be looking at that right now. In the long run.
Like PK you're talking about, or just core guys?
I don't know who the guy is. I'm with you. I don't think it would be PK.
Yeah.
But I think that this demise and the way this team hasn't had a response to this free fall and the leadership hasn't stood up, that young core leadership that you refer to, Brendan Gallagher, Max Pacioretty, PK Subban, the way those guys haven't stepped up and responded, and even if they didn't pull completely out of it, they haven't pulled out of it at all, and they're sagging. They're, you can see it in their body language. You can hear it in the way they talk after games. They're letting their emotions get the best of them in the wrong way. This now is serving as an opportunity for that management team, I think, to identify who their leaders are. I'm sure they're paying real close attention, seeing things that we don't see right now, saying, you know what? This guy isn't tough. We can't have that. We need somebody that's going to be able to respond better than this. I don't know if it's P.K. Subban that they're focused on, but I'm sure they're looking at Max Pacioretty right now.
Pacioretty.
Because I just don't think he earned that C, and I don't think he's earning it as we speak. I think he's a great player, but I think this is a kid that has had a lot handed to him through his career, whether it's been, you know, as a kid or up through high school ranks and prep school and college. And I think that, you know, when things go bad, he doesn't respond well. And I don't see that with P.K. Subban. I don't see that with Brendan Gallagher. Those, to me, would be your captains.
Yeah, I think those are the leaders.
Forward.
Those are the leaders of this team, not Max Pacioretty.
And Carey Price.
Yeah.
That's another thing. You miss Carey Price being the best player in the world on the ice.
Yeah.
But I think you miss Carey Price's leadership as well being around.
P.K. is the spiritual leader, I think, of the team. And Brendan Gallagher is the one that sets the tone toughness-wise, even though he's one of the smallest guys out there.
Yeah, it's unreal.
He'll pay the price more than anybody else out there. If Subban were to potentially ever be made available, I think it wouldn't matter how much of a sell job Malcolm Subban tried to get his brother here. There's no way he's going to get traded to the Boston Bruins.
No, but no, unless it was a three-way trade.
Yeah, and he had to come from someplace else rather than Montreal.
Exactly.
There's no way you're ever going to see the face of the Montreal Canadiens franchise traded straight up just to the Boston Bruins. I don't think in the history of hockey we'll ever see that.
No.
I think I could mark it down here as a commandment. Thou shalt never trade your captain from either the Bruins to the Canadiens or the Canadiens.
Does that even happen in the original 6 days? You know,
no.
I don't think it's going to happen now when there's plenty of more options to
Murph,
send
the
them
Bruins
to.
Barely make trades with the Buffalo Sabres. Forget about the Montreal Canadiens. All right, that's it for Montreal Habs talk. So all you people up in Montreal were happy about that one.
You soft.
All right, Murph. That's it for this week. Good stuff. Plenty of trade talk, plenty of Habs bashing. I think that serves the checklist for the Great American Hockey Show. Also, thank you very much to Tom Fitzgerald, former Bruins player, played for a number of different teams, now the assistant GM of the New Jersey Devils, just for the Ty Domi story alone, just fantastic stuff. Drive safely, everybody out there in the snow, and remember with the Great American Hockey Show, keep it great, keep it American, and always keep it about hockey.
If you want to hear more Comcast SportsNet podcasts or learn how to subscribe to our iTunes feed, head over to csnne.com/podcast.